From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Everything's a copy of 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 a copy.
They copy, they replicate, they mutate. They copy, they replicate, they mutate. They copy, they replicate, they mutate, mutate, mutate.
In China, copying can be an end in and of itself.
The scientists started repeating this mantra, which is cloning is reproduction, it's not resurrection.
I'm a clone, I'm good and I'm fine, I'm running more of the way. I'm too doctor, he's on the line, we'll take incubation another day. I'm all alone, so are we all. We're all clones, all are one and one are all, all are one and one are all.
Is everything really a copy of a copy of a copy? We'll try to find out in this hour. Take, for example, the music we're listening to right now. It is a remix of our theme music, created by one of our listeners. But would you call it a copy or an original? Today, we'll explore the philosophy behind copying. Also, why our culture keeps replicating apocalyptic thinking. And the heartbreaking story of an identical twin's loss of her sister. But first, do you want to visit a condensed version of Western architecture's greatest hits? Well, you might just want to pack your bags and catch the next flight to China. You'll be able to visit Thames Town in Shanghai and a larger-than-life replica of Venice in Hangzhou. Bianca Bosker is the author of Original Copies, Architectural Mimicry in Contemporary China. She talks with Steve Paulson about these copycat constructions.
I first of all discovered that this was going on in China, and this wasn't just happening in one city. This was happening throughout the country. So developers, government officials, individuals were building these homes and residential communities that replicated foreign cities and landscapes. And what really struck me was the disconnect between what a lot of critics and observers in the West had to say about them. They were very dismissive of them, very critical. And the fact that you had people in China that were willing to spend their life savings to live in a place that looked like the White House or Venice.
You're saying people actually built their own version of the White House?
Oh, absolutely. The White House is one of the most frequently copied buildings in China.
The White House, though, is huge. I mean, the real White House. How big is the Chinese version?
Well, you can obviously play with the scale a little bit, and they certainly do that not only for the White House and the Capitol building. What's striking is I think people have an image in their minds of these places as being miniature. And in fact, what's remarkable is that in some cases, the copies are bigger than the original. So just as an example, in Hangzhou, there's a copy of Venice, and it just dwarfs the feeling, the intimacy of being in the original in Italy. So you'll go there and the townhouses look very similar. They're similar colors. They have, you know, the beautiful arches and all of that. They even have canals and gondoliers. But the townhouses are bigger, wider, taller, and they don't have exactly the same density. So in some cases, yeah, they do play with the scale.
And there are other examples of some of the most famous landmarks in the world. For instance, the Eiffel Tower. Isn't there a Chinese version of that too?
Again, several Chinese versions of the Eiffel Tower. One of the most famous was one that was also in Hangzhou that I think was a two-thirds scale replica of the original. And it was on the Champs-Élysées Square in the middle of this huge development that really felt like Paris. You had, you know, these beautiful townhouses with the black tile roofs and the fountains. But what's interesting there is they actually had thrown together all of these different landmarks from France into one place. So you had on the one hand the Eiffel Tower and the very Parisian apartments, but then you also had the Arena of Nîmes, which is from a different part of France, and gardens from Versailles. So, you know, there's just a little bit of remodeling that goes on just to be sure that they've got all the greatest architectural hits of French architecture in one place.
So to take that one example of this little France in the city of Hangzhou, Is it private developers who are doing this? Is this a government operation? Who actually is making these copies?
So it varies from place to place. In this case, it was, I believe, a private developer who had gotten some cooperation and help from local government officials. And you find that a lot. One of the most incredible examples of this duplitecture movement was in Shanghai. And this was called the One City, Nine Towns Plan. And here, they were decided to build 10 satellite cities around Shanghai, each in the architectural style of a different European country. And this was spearheaded and financed by local government officials. One official, actually, that turned out to be quite corrupt and was later ousted from the Communist Party. But nonetheless, this was an effort by the state to actually build these massive replicas of England, Germany, Spain, and so on and so forth. So you find both kinds. You know, I actually found in my trips, I went to over 24 of these replica communities. The ones that had been built by private developers, like Vanka, tended to be more thriving and bustling than those that had been built by local officials or state-owned enterprises, you know, this sort of marriage between the private and public developers. And I think part of that had to do with the fact that the private developers spent a lot of time doing market research, studying the location, really making sure that the buildings that they were putting up would serve a market need. On the other hand, a lot of the government-sponsored developments have really remained these ghost towns, completely uninhabited, huge, sprawling developments that have maybe a handful of people living in them. Oftentimes, they're completely sold out, but no one's there. And that has to do with the fact that oftentimes the officials didn't take into account the infrastructure, how people were going to get there, the location, and didn't really put all the investment necessary to be sure that there would be schools and businesses and supermarkets and all of that. So in this case, I do think, as opposed to focusing on location, 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 you find the government developers instead thinking about imitation, imitation, imitation. In China, copying can be an end in and of itself. There's something remarkable and prized about the ability to create a convincing literal copy of something else. A good copy can be seen as an indication of mastery or skill. It's not a sign of a lack of innovation by any means.
Hmm. All of this raises the question of why are people doing this? I mean, why are the private developers creating whole communities? Why are people wanting to live in a copy of the White House, for instance? What's the appeal?
I think that China, in an effort to show that it's making it big, has turned to faking it big. When China copies Paris, it's not meant as an homage to France. It's meant as a celebration of China's success. And that's on both a personal and a national level, if you will. One of the big parts of my research was going and speaking to the people that were living in these communities to ask them what was so appealing about a fake California or a fake England. And, you know, you find that people are turning to these copies of Venice or Versailles as a way of showing their cultural sophistication. It's a very immediate, branded way of showing off what they've attained. I think a lot of the Chinese residents have chosen places that are instantly recognizable as high class, famous landmarks that were made for the rich and famous, whether it was the President of the United States or the King of France.
It's so complicated, though, China's relationship with the West. On the one hand, there's this admiration for what the West has accomplished, and yet there's also historically a lot of resentment. I'm a fan, for instance, of Chinese martial arts movies, and anything set historically 100 years ago, there is always sort of one of the storylines. There are the nasty Western imperialists, and the local homegrown hero has to kick them out. And so it would seem that you'd have both these things going on at the same time.
China obviously has a history of having Western architecture on its soil. But in those cases, the Western-style buildings were by and large built by the European powers in the concessions. Shanghai, for example, has the beautiful Bund area, but that was built by the British by and large, not by the Chinese. So you're seeing this strange rupture. I mean, China has such a rich architectural tradition all its own. Why not borrow from that or innovate a new, more modern style that's all Chinese as opposed to pilfering from the 17th, 18th century France or England or Italy? It is a bit bizarre, especially given China's very tenuous relationship with the West. But I think that, again, it goes back to by building something in the Western style, it becomes something China can do as opposed to something that's done to China by an outside power. And that's a very important difference. I think it's not about China building the Eiffel Tower because the country and its leaders and citizens are so obsessed and so in love with France. But it's much more about showing off, we can do this too. It's China, I think, being able to show we have the might and we have the money and we have the technical ability to build a replica of the Eiffel Tower. Again, this is a monument to China. This is not a monument to France.
You have a great quote from Howard French, the former China correspondent for the New York Times, who says, talking about this architectural imitation, he says, it is a statement of having arrived, of being rich and successful. It says, we can pick and choose whatever we want, owning a piece of the West. In fact, we're so rich, we can own the West without ever having to go there. Do you think he's right?
Oh, yeah, I do think he's right.
He's saying that it's almost a way of saying that we're going to best you. We can take the best that you have and, you know, we're going to even do better than what you've done.
I think China has embraced copying both for symbolic and practical ends. And what I mean by that is on a symbolic level, being able to recreate these foreign cities in China shows China's ability on a symbolic level to really rearrange the order of the universe and symbolically own its rivals. Right? China literally owns many White Houses right now. And it's no accident that the White House is one of the most copied buildings in China because it's so fraught with symbolism. I mean, China has picked the ultimate representation of the seat of power for the leader of the free world and has copied it over and over and over again and now owns it, literally.
Bianca Bosker is the author of Original Copies, Architectural Mimicry in Contemporary China. She spoke with Steve Paulson. What exactly does it mean to copy? And why do copies so often lead to sneering and ridicule? Marcus Boone's a good person to answer these kinds of questions. He's an English professor at York University in Toronto and the author of a book called In Praise of Copying. Boone talks with Anne Strange Champs.
Shopping malls, Starbucks, airports, we live in a world of stores and restaurants and cafes that are all copies of each other. I suppose you could say that the McDonald's hamburger you buy is a copy of a hamburger.
Well, okay, but let's push it a little further. Let's say then you go back to your house, you go to your townhouse, maybe your suburban semi-detached house, and usually if they were built in the last century, those buildings also tend to be produced en masse as copies of each other. And it's actually a very carefully constructed environment that, you know, feels as real as anything and yet is nonetheless a copy. Mm. And I think you could go through nearly every aspect of our lives, you know, which we experience as real and in some sense unique and original. And you could show that at almost every point, we were in actual fact interacting with copies. And that's what I do in my book then, is I really do try to push it as far as I can. And even the conversation we're having right now, at every level, the words we're using were learned, they're copies of words. We feel like when we're speaking them for the first time. But they only mean something because other people have used them and because there's a culture of copying, of imitation, that allows us to share a vocabulary, a grammar. And language itself functions through copying.
Does Buddhist philosophy reflect kind of a different perspective on copying or on imitation?
Yeah, it does. I don't think it's necessarily a unique perspective, but one thing that's very striking when you have a Buddhist practice is that mostly what you're doing is copying or imitating. You know, whether you're sitting and meditating on a cushion, whether you're saying a prayer, you're involved in very intense practices of copying. And what's interesting there is that it's believed that by imitation, by copying, you can overcome your bad habits, your suffering, and move towards a state called enlightenment. And that copying is a transformative practice in that sense.
And couldn't you say that, ironically, copying meditative practice is supposed to get you to the place where you experience this moment, this original moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, sometimes I think in the Zen tradition, they call it original mind even, and that's a state kind of free of concepts in a way, and that concepts already are involved in copying. And that's the kind of paradox that Buddhism works with, that you have to be aware of the degree that you're immersed in structures and practices of copying in order to have some kind of freedom from those very things.
That's lovely. Of course, sometimes copying is an act of deception. I mean, there's a reason that counterfeiting and forgery are illegal, and I mean, I imagine as a professor, you don't let your students plagiarize, or do you?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, my thoughts on plagiarism are somewhat complicated, just because when I do encounter a plagiarism case and I have to deal with it, which I do, one of the things I usually tell the students is, look, if you'd done what you did, and usually what students do is they'll go on the internet and instead of writing something out in their own words, they'll cut and paste several quotations from several internet sources and then kind of rework it a little bit and then hand it in. And usually they do a bad job of it and you can see that it's not really their language. And what I say to the students is, look, if you'd only just put your cuts and pastes in quotations and then try to use a few words of your own in establishing the link between these quotations, which is basically what you were trying to do anyway, this wouldn't be plagiarism. We'd just call this citation, and that's something we're encouraging.
So you're saying they just didn't copy well enough?
Exactly. And they didn't copy in a, I guess you would say, an honorable way, where they actually owned up to the fact that they were copying and they participated in a practice of copying that's actually acceptable.
You pose this really fascinating question in your book. What would or will the world look like when everyone can copy everything freely, when there are enough copies for everyone?
Mm-hmm.
So I want to put the question back to you. What do you think? How would that look and what would change?
I don't know. In one way, it's a scenario from a science fiction movie, but even since I wrote the book, things have been changing very rapidly. For example, the introduction of 3D printers, which is incredible that now, rather than relying on an industrial factory to produce the objects that we need to live, there's actually the possibility of owning a three-dimensional printer that we simply make objects with.
I was thinking about that. You know, instead of going to the store, we'll just print a copy of whatever the product is that we desire.
Yeah. And of course, like, there are great kind of possibilities that this will open up and terrible ones too. I mean, one of the things people talk about with 3D printers is that everyone will be able to manufacture their own weapons or guns, for example. On the other hand, access to medical tools will suddenly increase. So I think there's incredible opportunities there and probably incredible dangers. But I think without rethinking what our political and economic system is, and specifically things like how do we work, why do we work, what do we do when we work, there are going to be incredible obstacles to achieving or working with something that technically we're going to be capable of as a global society fairly soon.
What do you mean? What kinds of obstacles?
Well, for example, if you don't have to pay for anything because you can simply make a copy of it at home, what will the function of industry and business be at that point? And how will issues like intellectual property claims be dealt with at the moment where one has this kind of incredible control just through one's computer at home?
Do you think this is precisely the reason that we are so critical of copying, that we live in a culture in which copying has become easier and easier and easier. Maybe, you know, just as a result, we're more obsessed with and place more value on whatever we consider to be original, not a copy.
But if the basic problem of a global society is how we satisfy basic human needs, and the production of copies becomes so cheap that we can satisfy those needs without bankrupting ourselves as a global society, why wouldn't we embrace this and work towards it as the basis of a happier global society?
So you're saying we have this weird schizophrenic attitude in which our whole culture and economy produces more and more copies and our lives are based on copies, but we judge them all the time.
Yeah, and we don't really have a political and economic system that supports our technical capabilities as makers of copies. And I think you see that with just downloading culture on the internet, that at this point, a lot of people have access to basically any film or recording or image that they want. And yet, basically, we don't have a legal or economic structure that supports that. The question of how people will make a living when everyone has totally free access to copies of movies or music, we just don't have answers to those questions. And in some sense, we don't want to answer the questions because we prefer the current situation and we prefer having to go to work, et cetera, et cetera.
Marcus Boone is the author of In Praise of Copying. He spoke with Anne Strangeships. So what do you think of copying? And can imitation lead to innovation? You can get in touch with us through Facebook or Twitter, or send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll look at why apocalyptic thinking is contagious as we continue our hour on copies. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. These days, you can't avoid them. Doomsday scenarios. They permeate every area of contemporary culture, from economics and ecology to technology and theology. Barry Vacker teaches media and cultural studies at Temple University, and he's the author of a book called The End of the World Again, Why the Apocalypse Meme Replicates in Media, Science, and Culture. Vacker talks with Steve Paulson.
Why are you so interested in our obsession with apocalyptic thinking?
That's a really great question, and one I wrestled with in writing this book. And I think it actually goes way back to my childhood. I grew up in the suburbs of Texas, and I had my own little portable television. And we had some stations that would show these odd, quirky, apocalyptic films. Failsafe, Dr. Strangelove, to the more B-level movies like Them with the giant ants.
I tell you, gentlemen, science has agreed that unless something is done and done quickly, man, as the dominant species of life on Earth, would be extinct within a year.
And I never really could explain my fascination with these films because I never thought ants were going to come get us or that all these scenarios were going to unfold. But at some point, I realized that they were actually really raising questions about human existence and about how we understand what it might be like if we were all gone. What would it really mean if we were to disappear, if we were to obliterate ourselves, or if some species was to take over? And so I think at some deep level, they're challenging us to think about the meaning of human existence.
For born in that swirling inferno of radioactive dust, were things so horrible, so terrifying, so hideous, there is no word to describe them.
We may be witnesses to a biblical prophecy come true, and there shall be destruction and darkness come upon creation, and the beast shall reign over the earth.
So I think at some deep level, they're challenging us to think about the meaning of human existence.
Well, and you talk about what you call the apocalyptic meme, and we should define our terms for a moment here. What do you mean by the apocalyptic meme? What's a meme?
The meme is a term coined by Richard Dawkins in his book, The Selfish Gene. And what he meant by the term meme is that ideas evolve very much like genes. And so they copy, they replicate, they mutate, and so on. And those memes, like genes, those memes that confer survival advantages will be those that continue to exist. And so a meme, in essence, is really any idea, belief, or behavior that can be copied and replicated and passed along. From the simplest thing as fashion and tattoos and art, to science, to philosophy, to more complex things like worldviews, ideologies, economic systems, pretty much everything humans do can be understood in terms of a meme, something that's been copied and replicated and passed along.
And then you say there are sometimes collections of memes, related memes, that are clustered together, what you call meta-memes.
Yeah, and again, I'm getting that term from Susan Blackmore, who's done a lot of work extending the ideas of Dawkins and others on memes. But a meta-meme is a collection of memes that are all woven in together. So, for example, let's take the meme of capitalism. Well, that has lots of meanings. It has a lot of other lesser memes, corporations, mass production, maybe exploitation, free market, free enterprise, profit, consumer society. It's got a lot of other memes woven into it. So within these larger narratives, there are lots of lesser memes all woven in together.
So you are saying that there is an apocalyptic meme out there.
There's many of them. They're all over the place.
Okay. Well, tell me, what form do these apocalyptic memes take?
Well, this came off the whole Mayan apocalyptic hysteria. And I think what's interesting in our society is that the Mayan apocalypse, even though 27% of Americans believed that it was likely to happen.
You're saying 27% of Americans thought the world was going to end like the Mayan prophecy?
Yes, according to a survey by National Geographic, yes.
Really?
Yes, 27% thought it was likely to happen. The number in China was 20%. So there are a lot of beliefs out there of various apocalyptic scenarios. The Mayan one was easy to discredit, but I think that kind of worked as a cover story because, let's face it, the war on terror is apocalyptic. I mean, let's look at Afghanistan, what has happened to Afghanistan after the Soviet Union invaded in 1979 and 80, and that lasted a decade, and then with the Americans and since 9/11. So that's apocalyptic. Iraq is apocalyptic. I think you could say that war itself is apocalyptic, and humans have been waging war for a long, long time. In fact, in the new millennium, since the year 2000, humans have spent over $15 trillion on war and military. That's $2,000 a person waging warfare.
So this obsession with the coming end of the world, I mean, it helps to explain a lot of the books and movies and TV shows that trade on this idea. And, you know, dystopianism obviously fits into this as well. The sci-fi fantasy stuff, zombies, vampires, it's all sort of part of the same thing. But then I guess it raises the question, well, are all those movies and books and TV shows creating this apocalyptic fervor, or are they reflecting it?
I think it's probably both, because growing up in the Cold War, which ended in 1990 and 91, there was the fear of the nuclear apocalypse. That is not on the radar near as much, although it might be because there's still over 22,000 nuclear warheads in the world. But we now have the ecological apocalypse, whether that's measured as climate change, rising ocean levels, global warming, ecological destruction. There's also the idea of a resource apocalypse, that we're going to exhaust the Earth's resources. Then there's a variety of technological apocalypses. In other words, maybe the nuclear power plants will melt down, or maybe we're going to run out of energy. And there's also the idea of the digital apocalypse, that we will create these machines that will be so powerful and so small that they will go in and alter human consciousness and create a new human. So the real human will be gone and be replaced by some kind of digitalized human. That's sort of the Ray Kurzweil scenario.
Right.
And you mentioned the zombie apocalypse. And I would say there's two others. The cosmic apocalypse, the idea that Earth could get obliterated by the cosmos, be it a meteor, asteroid, black hole, supernova. The science shows on television do a lot to further that idea that the universe could wipe us out. There's a show called The Universe that shows up on the History Channel, and they have numerous scenarios with these scientists sort of gleefully explaining the ways the Earth could meet its demise.
This is how a scientist can get on television, you know, predict the end of the Earth.
That's right, exactly. In fact, these guys, you would think they were like Roland Emmerich announcing the new blockbuster, you know?
There's kind of a paradox here. I mean, going back to this idea of the meme, and again, I mean, if we draw the analogy to evolution, I mean, for creatures to exist into the next generation, they have to be successful. They have to reproduce, which raises the question of why are these doom and gloom scenarios so popular? You know, they're kind of frightening. Why do people get off on them?
Well, it's interesting because as a meme, to survive, they have to have some kind of advantage. So in my book, I list seven advantages or seven benefits. All of these apocalypse scenarios offer what-if scenarios. What if this happened? What if we had an ice age? What if the temperature of the Earth heated up? What if extraterrestrials came to us and our planet and decided to wipe us out? What if we had a nuclear meltdown, as in the China syndrome? And so they have all these what-if scenarios. Embedded in that is the possibility that something could end. Is it going to be the end of industrial civilization, the end of humanity, the end of capitalism, whatever it might be? But pregnant in an end is also a beginning. Oh, wow, if we could just get past this wave of destruction, we'll have a new chance for a beginning. So the scenarios always have embedded, sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly, an end and a beginning. And spinning off those two things, because everybody kind of wants to know how things are going to end, right? We want to know, hey, this is going to end, and hey, there's a new possibility, right? We always have those in our lives because we were born and we know we're going to die. So ends and beginnings are important.
You're really talking about rebirth then. The fantasy that the old, the corrupt, the decaying will be wiped clean and we'll have a new, fresh, wonderful start.
Right. It's just what Madison Avenue promises with so many products, right? You'll get a new beginning, a new chance to begin again, and the old will be swept away. One of the ends that's terrifying is this sort of fear of the future, the idea that somehow the future is messed up. Somehow it's going to get worse, that the good old days are better than the days to come, that tomorrow is going to be terrifying and we got to go back to yesterday. And that fear of the future undergirds a lot of these sort of conservative or neoconservative apocalyptic scenarios, cultural apocalypses, whether it's immigration or gay rights, all the things that are perceived as largely negative by conservatives or fundamentalists or evangelicals or whatever. So all that sort of fear of the future, or that there's just simply no future. And I think that was part of the fear of the Cold War, is that somehow we knew that we could immediately get wiped out and there might not be a long-term future. And so there have been any number of films that have dealt with that, from Dr. Strangelove to Failsafe. I would say even a film like The Matrix has a deep fear of the future. But another benefit is the idea that somehow out of this there'll be a transformation of human consciousness, that somehow we'll come out a better species if we just survive it. And this is a very optimistic view. Once we survive our mistakes, once we conquer climate change, we'll be transformed. Or maybe by transforming consciousness, we'll conquer the climate problems. And I think that's sort of what's in Al Gore's message, is that somehow we can transform human consciousness and society to cooperate on a global scale to fend off severe climate change. So that's what makes his view so optimistic, as opposed to the many much more pessimistic views of climate change.
Barry Vacker is the author of The End of the World Again, Why the Apocalypse Meme Replicates in Media, Science, and Culture. He spoke with Steve Paulson. So what do you think about Vacker's ideas about the apocalypse meme? You can share your thoughts with us through Facebook or Twitter, or send us an email through our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, animal cloning, and a young woman talks about the loss of her twin sister as we conclude our Hour on Copies. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We love our pets. We often can't imagine life without them. One day they will die and we'll be left to carry on alone. Or will we? Is cloning the solution to this problem? Emily Anthes is the author of Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. So what exactly is a clone?
Well, there are a couple different technical definitions of a clone. Scientists talk about, for instance, cloning genes, which is just copying a gene in the lab. But when it's used in public discussion, really it means one thing, and that's an animal or a creature that is an identical twin of another creature. It's essentially an exact genetic copy.
I don't think there's any way to talk about cloning now without talking about Dolly, who was a lamb born, when, 1996 or so?
That's right.
Quite a while ago, but it changed everything, didn't it?
It did. Dolly was significant because she was the first clone of an adult mammal. Scientists had had some success previously cloning embryos from, say, frogs. But that's not as useful from a commercial standpoint. If you want to make a copy of a champion racehorse, for instance, or a beloved pet, you want to clone the adult. You don't want to clone an embryo because you don't know if the animal's going to be superlative or not.
So after she was born, things changed, right? I mean, they were able to do things they hadn't been able to do before?
Exactly. For one thing, it really launched the public discussion on cloning and brought that to the forefront, but it also presented all sorts of new opportunities for researchers, particularly agricultural researchers, who were very excited about this technology. There's big money in breeding great horses or great bulls, and cloning gives livestock owners and ranchers a new way to make exact genetic copies of their best performers. So there was a lot of interest in taking this technology and putting it to use in the livestock industry.
It's worth remembering, I guess, as you do in the beginning of the book, that we have spent hundreds of years trying to make another generation that is as good as the generation that came before. We've bred horses, we've bred dogs, bred cattle, I imagine. But this isn't the same as that. It's a huge leap forward, isn't it?
Yes, and it takes some of the guesswork out of selective breeding. Of course, as I also talk about, cloning has limitations, and there's no guarantee that just because the animal you start with was a champion racehorse that the clone will be as well. But at least you know you're starting with the exact same genetic material, and in theory, that gives you a better shot of replicating whatever success you had.
So after Dolly was born, what happened? Was there a huge leap with all sorts of other clones suddenly in the world?
It wasn't sudden, but what was sudden, I think, was all of a sudden a whole bunch of other labs deciding, hey, we've got to try this. So rather than trying to make another sheep, what you saw was a lot of different researchers trying to clone other species. So slowly we saw the first cloned cows, the first cloned deer, the first cloned cats. You had new species being cloned in this way.
One of the things that was kind of fascinating, and I guess again caught the public's eye, was something that happened at Texas A&M not long after Dolly's birth, I think. And that was the beginning of, what do you call it? It's not the pet revolution. It's like that.
Yeah, pet cloning, essentially. There was huge public interest in this. It's perhaps in retrospect not surprising, given how many people feel intensely attached to their pets. But the theory was that if you had a pet you loved and it went on to the great kennel in the sky, then wouldn't cloning be a wonderful way to get a new copy of it? And a wealthy pet owner actually approached the scientists at Texas A&M and said, I'm going to give you $3.7 million to try and make a clone of my dog. It was originally just supposed to be sort of a research project funded by this millionaire. But of course, once the public got wind of it, the researchers were flooded with phone calls. Everyone wanted to know how they could get in on this, how they could sign their pets up for cloning.
This was what was called the Missiplicity Project?
That's right. The millionaire's dog, the dog that he wanted to clone, was a border collie mix named Missy. So there was the Missiplicity Project. The company they then founded to clone people's pets was called Genetic Savings and Clone, and so on.
Well, I guess the question that immediately follows is, was there another Missy? Did they successfully clone the border collie?
Yes, eventually. The original project was not a success. The Texas researchers did not manage to get a copy of Missy. As it turns out, for a variety of reasons, dog eggs are much harder to work with than cat eggs or cow eggs, and so they just didn't figure it out. Years later, some scientists in Korea eventually did clone Missy. They actually cloned three of her. So there are three Missy copies now running around out there.
It's important to note that this isn't really as simple as it sounds. It's not as though once Dolly was cloned, suddenly it was possible to do whatever you wanted. It doesn't always work. In fact, it doesn't often work, does it?
That's right. It's an incredibly inefficient process. So most scientists can now get a clone out of this whole process if they want to, but it takes a lot of failed attempts. You often have to create dozens or maybe even hundreds of cloned embryos, and only some of them will be viable in the womb, only some of them will make it to term, and maybe only one or two out of 100 embryos will actually be born and survive its birth.
It shows a lot of determination, but people clearly want this to happen.
Yes, and it also, of course, raises ethical questions about, are we willing to bear these costs of these stillbirths, all these cloned embryos, in order to get one special animal?
I guess one of the first answers is that there are, or seem to be, a lot of people who want to have, especially their pets, their cats, their dogs, the animals that have become close to them, they'd like to have them again.
That's right. And that's something that actually unsettled the researchers who were trying to do this dog and cat cloning, is they worried that pet owners, because of their devotion to their animals, might actually be taken advantage of. It's still an incredibly expensive procedure. There are two companies in South Korea where you can send your dog's cells to have them cloned, but it's $100,000 to do that. And scientists worry that people would think they were getting their same dog back. And that's just not the case. You're, of course, getting an identical twin. And because it's born so much later and potentially has a different upbringing, is going to be a different animal. It's not the same pet. And that's why the scientists sort of started repeating this mantra, which is cloning is reproduction. It's not resurrection.
The end of the book, you write about looking into your crystal ball of biotechnology. Is that what you see when you gaze into it?
An increase in cloning?
Yeah.
I do think it will become more common. It has become more common, particularly in the livestock industry. And I think we could see it being used for interesting applications, for instance, cloning animals that are resistant to various diseases, which would be a great breakthrough, I think. There's been some work on that already. And I think we'll see more of those things start to happen. Whether it ever becomes a totally mainstream method of animal reproduction, I'm not sure, but I'm certain we'll see more of it.
Emily Anthes is the author of Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. When an identical twin dies, there's a 50% chance the surviving twin will also die within 2 years. Fortunately, that didn't happen to Krista Perivani after she lost her sister, Kara. Krista's written a memoir about the special bond she shares with her identical twin sister. It's called Her.
We'd really been sort of separated by an event that happened in my sister's life. She was raped by a stranger while she was walking her dog in the woods during her first year of graduate school. And at that moment, we'd felt that we'd been untwinned, and mortality was a real question at that point. My sister really felt that she hadn't survived that attack, and in a way, I think part of her felt as if she had left who she was on the forest floor that day.
That rape is something that you both had to deal with. There's no getting around it. The two of you were so, so very close. Well, there's a hint at it earlier in the book. You talk about how people used to say to you that they always wanted to be a twin.
Mm-hmm.
And your response to that was what?
Cut yourself in half and see how it feels. And actually, my sister wrote that part of the book. That's quoted directly from her manuscript. Yeah, that was really the answer to that question. We felt lucky to have one another, but we felt very worried that one day we wouldn't have one another. But We really didn't start talking about that until we were younger adults in our 20s, and it seemed like a real possibility that we might be separated by death. That was always on our minds.
It wasn't until the rape, then, that you began to look at it?
It really wasn't until the rape, no. My sister suffered very deeply from depression after the rape, and she went on really a kind of suicidal mission with drugs. She couldn't rescue herself from the pain and the trauma of her rape, and she began self-medicating, first with benzodiazepines and then with heroin. And it was very obvious to both of us that the path was not going to end in a good place for her if she didn't stop taking those drugs, and she refused.
One of the difficulties that you faced, and that's clear in the way you've written this book, is that it's hard for you to be both here after she's gone and still feeling so much of the life the two of you had together before she died. It's heartbreaking to hear you so clearly in your writing talk about still being a twin, even though you use the phrase untwinned as a part of the rape.
That was something about losing my sister that was very unexpected to me. It was as if I didn't know who I was after she died, as if I had sort of been cut in half, if you will. And I went to the mirror after she died, and I looked at myself, and I saw her. And during our lives together, we were always trying to differentiate from one another. Identical twins will find the smallest things that are different and kind of go with those. But as I was looking at myself in the mirror, she was really staring right back at me. And I was faced then at that moment with realizing that I was a twin, but I wasn't a twin. And I wasn't sure how I was going to navigate that as I went along in my life, because my sister really did feel like the most important part of me. It was sort of like what people describe when they've lost a limb, the phantom limb syndrome, where you have this appendage and you can't see it, but you can feel it. And for me, losing my sister was sort of like having a phantom twin, where I couldn't see her, but I could feel her very acutely next to me, and I couldn't put my hands on her. And it really was sort of the biggest loss that I think I could have endured at that moment in my life.
It had to have worried you, because when she was raped, I know it's hard, but it wasn't an easy rape, if such a thing is even possible to imagine. It was a vicious, brutal beating that she took. It must have felt, because she was so much a part of you, like it happened to you to some extent.
It really did. And, you know, if I'm honest with myself, it still feels that way. I think a lot about what happened to my sister that day, and it's not a memory that I have because she told me about it and that resonated with me. It's a memory that I have because I created it for myself in a way that I created a lot of the memories that we shared. And I would never dare say that her rape happened to me, because it certainly didn't, but it lives on in me and in my memory in a way that is so deeply embedded that I can't really live without that. I bring it into my home.
Did she talk to you about it? Was she able to talk to you about it?
She was able to talk to me about it, and something really magical happened to me while I was writing this book, actually. I had tried to write the story of my sister's rape for about 6 weeks, and I couldn't do it. It was very close to fiction for me, and it felt uncomfortable as I was writing. I wanted to write a memoir. And really, I felt at that moment that I was going to have to give up writing the book. And I went to visit my mother one weekend, and I went up to my sister's bedroom, and I had wanted to spend some time with her things. I sat on the floor, and I looked under the bed, and there was this giant Tupperware container filled with journals that I'd never seen, and I opened one up, and inside of it was my sister's account of the rape, and she'd written it for the police, I think. There was a little legal document inside of the front flap, and she'd never told me the story like that, and she tells the reader exactly what happened to her in the book, because it's exactly the account of her rape that I was able to use here. And maybe I didn't know in life, but I definitely know now what happened that day.
Is it better, actually, to know, or was your imagining even worse than the reality?
It was much better to know. It was better for me at the end, looking at the end of this process of writing the book, to be able to know my sister in the way that she had so needed me to know her. I felt when I lost her that I would never be able to reconcile all of our differences, and really the wedge that was put between us with drugs and with the attack that she suffered. And I really did find that at the end of writing this book that I was closer to her in a way that I had never been while she was alive. And I also found that the nearer I came to Kara in writing this book, the farther away she was from me in my regular life. So I did take on some of her more destructive qualities when she died. It wasn't just her image that I saw in the mirror. I was also replicating some of the drug use and the infidelity that she had acted out in her marriage. I replicated that in the one that I had. And this book really saved me from that kind of life because I was able to find my sister in writing and in a way that I could never find her outside of the book.
One of the things we haven't talked at all about, although I guess we've hinted at it, is a statistic that must have grabbed you and worried you almost to death. You write that 50% of twins follow their identical twin in dying within 2 years. And that almost happened to you?
It nearly happened to me. I nearly overdosed on drugs several times. I attempted suicide several times. I actually was in a terrible car accident. I was hit by a dump truck, and that had nearly killed me. I was determined to follow my sister into death. I didn't know where else to go. I really didn't. You know, it took me probably about 4 years, and not two, to realize that I was going to survive. And I'd had a moment with my sister, actually, while she was alive, where we were driving. We were on our way to take a photograph, and she looked at me, and she said, "If you die, I will kill myself." And I looked at her and I said, "If you die, I will survive you." And I kind of kept that mantra in my mind as I went along, knowing that I wasn't going to go in the same place, no matter how hard I'd pushed myself in that direction. I knew that there must be something on the other side that I could find meaning in and a new life.
Krista Piravani, she's the author of Her. She is now happily remarried and has a daughter named Josephine. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Copies. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Sarah Nix. Special thanks to Peter Serla for the remix of our theme music, and to our special guest engineer, Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.